You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe white-tailed deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Hi, I'm John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. This is a Maximize Your Hunt. Welcome back, everyone. I have been on a binger the past couple of days cutting timber. I'm exhausted, and I want to just state this for everybody. You need to have your wits about you when you're cutting timber. You need to be very aware and pause. Take time to breathe and think through every cut that you're making. If you don't have the experience doing timber management, cutting specific larger or shorter species, hinge cutting, whatever the technique you employ, don't do it. And take the time to start small. Learn. Go through the education. You know, I've kind of learned on the job, and I think that's not necessarily the best way to do it. But through experiences, I've realized what not to do. And so when you're physically drained and you're deprived of energy, you need to take your time and slow down. It's just a conscious thing to think about. I'm cutting tomorrow again, and then I'm on the road to Pennsylvania for consulting. And I'll probably cut again the following week. And I just would employ people, slow down. It's important to, you know, trees are not worth your life. And that's a really simple equation that I think sometimes, you know, we all forget. And, you know, deer aren't everything, or the focal species that you're kind of interested, you know, don't mean that, you know, you should, you know, let go of the things that are most important to you. And for me, it's safety. It's taking my time. And I just want to relay that. And the other thing I'll say, as you get older, I work with clients that are older, you know, the physicality of this is brutal. I'm 41 years old. You know, just to be personal, I'm 41 years old. I'm in good physical shape. You know, I was an athlete in college. You know, I'm strong. I'm 6'1". I'm not a small guy. And this physically, it's the most brutal sport I've ever had to endure in my life. And I just relay that because it's not just felling trees. Trees have to go in specific location. It's moving timber. It's bucking timber. It just, there's a lot involved within it. And I think sometimes we don't realize how complicated it can be. And it's a thinking man sport as well. It's not just a simple, we're just going to lay trees on the ground. We want to lay trees in specific areas. We want to pile tops. If you're hinge cutting, there's a lot of physicality that comes with that. So I just want to relay those points to folks that are in the field and thinking, you know, this is timber management season for us. In my particular state, there's a burn ban right now, so you can't be burning in New York, at least, you know, for purposes like many of us would like to do. So, you know, there's a limitation that's employed on us, and we just need to be conscious of that. Not that I approve of that. I just wanted to relay that point. All right, let's bump over. Enough of that. Enough of my jabbing. We'll get to the topic. So this week I have Kyle Hedges on. He's not been on the podcast before. He's a consultant with Land and Legacy. If you've listened to their podcast, it's fantastic. Great bunch of folks, a lot of knowledge, a lot of insight, and good experiences. He's also a state wildlife biologist, and we're going to talk about quail. And this is a topic where I'm a little naive. I do have some understanding and knowledge. I've worked in areas where quail are present, but we're going to focus on how to build habitat for quail. And then we're going to go through kind of the natural processes, you know, where quail have kind of where they've had issues or limitations in the landscape. Why do we have those issues, and, you know, how to overcome those and be more conscious of that focal species. So let me get Kyle on the line. Hey, Kyle, how are you? Are you on the line?
Hey, doing great. Good to be here.
All right, good. You listen to my rant, and, you know, I really want this to be about you and your mastery level in this particular area, meaning I think a lot of people don't realize, and I've listened to you quite a bit, and I don't want to say from an inspirational standpoint, but when I listen to you, it motivates me. It gives me purpose. And the way that you and Frank have kind of dialogued about some of these topics, I said, I need to get you on the podcast. So, you know, to pump you up anymore, I'm just happy that you're here and you took time out of your night for me. So I wanted to thank you.
Well, Well, I appreciate that. We always laugh, and with Matt and Adam, you know, too, with Land and Legacy, that, you know, most of the business that, that we all participate in is deer-centric. But, man, the quail game, if quail were as easy as deer, and it's not to to snub deer management by any means. There's plenty of complications, but quail are so much more difficult. They're a bigger pain in the rear is the problem. So anyway, and they're picky, and it's caused them some struggles over the years, and we'll get into all that.
Let's talk just about biology, and let's kind of go through, you know, some of the things, their adaptations, you know, how they roam around the landscape, maybe nesting. You know, the conditions that they, you know, the time of year, all the things that kind of surround quail specifically. And then we'll get into the demands. And then we'll talk a little bit about habitat loss, because I think those are kind of the mainstay discussion points around this particular species. So where do they exist across the landscape? Typical region?
Yeah, so they have a giant distribution, which makes them quite interesting. I mean, they're literally from Florida west to Texas, all the way up into Nebraska. They'll even squeak up into Wisconsin in good years, and all the way east. I mean, now they've been extirpated from some states like Pennsylvania, but you know, wild quail quite recently in the last decade or two were clear up in the Northeast too. So a massive range, which is interesting because there's such different habitat types, right? You know, West Texas is completely different than Georgia. Pine plantations, yet bobwhite quail exist in both of those types of habitat, just completely different landscapes. So huge range, but that's shrinking all the time. They've been extirpated, like I say, especially east to west. They're failing east, and that cliff that they're falling off of is inching its way west.
Yeah, so, you know, that's a concerning aspect of that particular bird's overall survival. And obviously it's been a detractant. Its lack of expansion is kind of, it's prone to say, okay, what is going on in their locality or across these different regions or ranges that are impacting quail specifically? I think the farming culture obviously is one thing that has changed tremendously, particularly here in the East and some particular regions, as well as the way the forests are being managed. So I'd like you to dialogue a little bit about, you know, I guess the pitfalls or what's been happening across maybe portions of the landscape that you work, et cetera, that have impacted the quail.
Yeah, let's just go through the quick and dirty of what happened. So, and I won't even dive in deep into the explosion of quail, but real quick, you know, after World War II, people came home, they settled farmsteads, and quail exploded. Quail actually went way beyond, you know, what they would have been 300 years ago as far as population numbers. So massive quail increase because of all these little broken up farms, farmettes everywhere, right? All across the country. But over time, yes, mainly the farming community. I'm not picking on the farming community. It's just civilization. It's just the advancement of man. This is what happens. So, you know, better chemicals, more efficient farm equipment, less weeds in fields, less diversity in fields. If you look at graphs of corn and soybeans, you know, there's millions and millions and millions of more acres now than there was in the 1960s and 70s of corn and beans. There was a lot more small grains. People were feeding, you know, to a milk cow. And when my dad was growing up, you know, you had a milk cow, so you had a little bit of sorghum. You had all these different grain types and different pasture types around. Introduced grasses, fescue, brome, down south, bahia, Bermuda grass, all these, those are all not native. They're not supposed to be here. And we've introduced those all across the quail, bobwhite quail's range. And all of that's had a devastating effect, of course. We've expanded farm fields. We've taken out fence rows. You mentioned the forest side of it. Well, where we haven't, let's say, taken out forest, our forest acres actually, for example, in Missouri have increased compared to 300 years ago. We have a lot more. We have tens of thousands more acres of forest. The problem is it's not quality forest. It's stuff that used to be open prairie and grasslands where quail would have been, you know, occupying, has turned into Osage, orange, cedar, locust, you know, junk What was old fields for a while, we managed those for deer, but then this turns into junk timber. So a combination of all of that, the loss of fire as people populated the landscape, you can't have fires raging across. So Smokey the Bear was a great idea, but the intent was taken wrong. You know, forest fires are bad. Well, not all fires bad. Unintentional fire is bad. Anyway, all this combined and the farming practices and better herbicides, next thing you know, we've lost the diversity of plants on the landscape. We've lost the diversity of small grains, small fields. All of that small farm, dairy, think of dairy farms in the 60s and 70s, you know, those just don't exist across the landscape. It's massive farm operations and massive introduced grass pastures.
Yeah. And obviously, you know, grassland and shrubland seem to be, or shrubland as well, seem to be kind of the premise behind, you know, what these general, if you're going to generalize across the region, ideal habitat conditions. And those vegetations have depleted. I mean, grasslands alone, certainly in our areas, they were of low abundance. Now they're, you know, not even existent. But grasslands alone and the introduction of non-native plants, you know, have just basically degraded those to the point where I don't want to say they're non-existent, but the percentage-wise, at least compared to, you're saying, the booming forest situation, you know, is minimized. So, you know, thinking just yes. about that from a scale standpoint, I want to take you down a road here and I want to just understand more about the particular animal and, you know, how do they, you know, how does it work, right? Do they have brooding pairs? What's the reproduction cycle? How long do they live? Can you give some basics just about the animal itself?
Yeah. Basic Bob White ecology. So yes, they'll pair up. They're not monogamous. Our research, we've done massive research project here in Missouri and they're not necessarily monogamous. Sometimes they will breed with a couple, two or three different males, but at any rate, start pairing up typically, you know, April. Down south, they're going to have nests hatching by late May, mid to late May. We have tracked nests hatching in Missouri, for example, so the middle of the range as far as north and south, anywhere from late May all the way into early October. So the entire summer is nesting season. They will tuck their ground nesters, so they're exposed, you know, to snake predation of eating eggs, raccoons, possums, skunks, all the predators have accessibility. Their lifespan is less than 8 months, so most of them never see their first birthday. They're a species that relies on explosive reproduction. So a good year, and sometimes the male will participate in brooding as well. In fact, sometimes the male will take a brood, and a female will try to re-nest or make a second nest. That's not super common, but it does happen. But point being, in good conditions, good habitat, they can explode in a year or two and really rebound from, you know, some catastrophic event or things like that. But in general, 80% mortality. So let's say you have a covey of, you know, 10 birds, a family group, two parents and eight chicks that make it. You're only going to have two left next spring. And they're going to, of course, they trade family members for genetic diversity, but then they're going to make another covey. So they'll tuck a nest at the base of a native grass clump or some type of vegetation. So that's where the non-natives come into play. That becomes a problem when they hatch, just like young turkeys, they can't thermoregulate their body temperature. So it's critical. The main things that bobwhite quail have to have are just the same as turkeys with one extra. They have to have some nesting substrate, so some type of clumps of grass, and they'll tuck their nest at the base, actually, you know, tunnel into it. Two, they need a diversity of plants that attracts bugs, because that's what they're going to eat all summer, grasshoppers and various bugs. And they need bare ground. And when we talk about bare ground, we're not talking about a disc food plot. We're talking about the interstitial space between plants. Because they can't thermoregulate, if they get wet with the dew, they die of exposure. The first 2 weeks, they can't thermoregulate, so they have to be able to move between plants. So picture ragweed, you know, stalks. That's perfect. Kind of a canopy plant, but the stalk is skinny. They can move between, pick little bugs off of the stalks of ragweed, and not get wet in the morning dew. And then they also need a woody escape cover, shrubby cover, like think of a plum thicket. That's something that the turkeys don't necessarily need and the quail do. Turkeys, of course, need a roost site. But anyway, so there's diversity of plants, bare ground, that and escape cover, some shrubby escape cover. That's their basic premise. High mortality rate, but explosive reproduction when the conditions are right and the habitat is right.
Well, you just threw a lot at me. And certainly interesting that the male is able to raise a brood, essentially. And I'm assuming in some cases a female may be bred by multiple males, potentially, based on your example you just gave. Is that a normalcy thing, or are they paired up typically?
Yeah, so both can happen. Sometimes we would see, you know, a male will breed her, and she'll go start a second nest, and he'll take off and raise the brood, or she'll go find a new boyfriend. But again, that's not a super high percentage thing. You know, less than 10% are pulling off double broods. So it's not super common, but the further south you go, the more common it is. So down in Texas, southern Georgia, those things do happen a little more frequently in ideal habitat and perfect weather.
All right. I've got a couple more questions for you. So, you know, you introduced this family composition, but when it comes to specifics, like does the brood eventually, as they mature, do they leave and form their own family groups eventually because of their short life cycle? When are they able to start producing or breeding? When is that in their life cycle? When does that start to happen?
Yeah, they've got to make it to a year old to be a breeder. So they're not breeding within the same year that they were, or the same summer they were born. So these coveys, these family broods, will spend all summer together, and then there's what's called a fall shuffle. So typically September, October. And there'll be some trading of chicks in the summer, but the big shuffle happens in the fall. And so literally as broods pass each other, they whistle every morning, everybody knows where everybody's at, and as broods pass each other in their daily activities, they'll trade kids. They'll literally trade chicks, and it's for a genetic diversity, right? Like, hey, you go with that family and we'll take three of your kids. And I mean, some days I wanted to do that with my own kids growing as they were growing up.
I can relate to that right now. Continue though.
So it's this fall shuffle, and then you'll have, you know, pairs that maybe lost their brood, right? The nest success is only, good years in Texas, it'll exceed 50%. Our best sites in Missouri were 45%. So nest success isn't that high, and then you get some brood loss. So let's say a third of them make it to fall. So you have a fair amount of you have pairs and singles that don't have any chicks attached to them. So that fall shuffle, they'll join up with a family group as well to form coveys that are typically, you know, 10 to 15 birds in size. And that, so they can make a nice circle, a roost circle for safety, everybody looking out. If you don't know anything about how they roost, look it up. It's really neat. They're all, their rear ends are touching and they're all looking out for safety, roost on the ground. But all this happens in the fall, this fall shuffle, and then those coveys try to make it till next spring, and whoever's left just starts pairing up, trading around, and we saw big movements too. Touch real quick on home ranges. You know, in the fall, these birds will move, more genetic diversity. Sometimes a male will pass 5, 6, 7 females for whatever reason and go a mile and then meet up with some girl a mile away. I'm not sure why. I don't know if he was rejected on the way or how it all works, but I'm sure, again, it goes back to genetic diversity. But these broods during the summer, as they're raising their chicks, and again, we need diverse vegetation, lots of weeds, lots of bare ground. Weeds aren't bad. We want weeds. and lots of bugs. You know, they may only use 5 or 10 acres, but in the fall, a lot of their home ranges we saw would be, you know, upwards of a couple hundred acres. So they can get pretty big and use a pretty wide array of an area.
Let's pause on some of those topics. So I want to get towards that to the end when we talk about how to manage habitat. Let's look a little bit about, you know, some of the deficiencies. At least one of the concerns that I would have is after something is born, its ability to thermoregulate is critical to its survival. You brought that up earlier. What are the environments like? You know, a lot of times, you know, we get these very heavy rains now. You know, what the weather shift has done something in some of these ecoregions where there's high intensity rain, and it's a timing of a lot, especially with, in our case, with turkeys. That has become very problematic over the years just because we've had a lot of climatic shift. In your situation with rain, what type of disturbances are climatic conditions, dependency issues that happen on the landscape? How does that impact the bird specifically after, you know, that initial, I think you said 30-day window where they eventually hatch? What are the limitations or concerns around that period just post-birth?
Yeah, so it's those cool mornings, either or the heavy rains, as you mentioned, can be devastating. We've even had adult birds die. You know, we had a 10-inch rain over 2 days, and we lost, on one study site, lost 10% of our adult birds. So not just chicks. Yeah, devastating. So heavy rains are certainly bad, but it's those low morning temperatures, even just dew. You get some of those June mornings, say here in Missouri, and you have a heavy dew, and it's the temperatures down in the, you know, I don't know, low 50s, and you can't thermoregulate. You know, you're only 4 days old, you're twice the size of a bumblebee, and you get wet, it's over, you know. So those can be devastating, but their range is so big, you have all these other factors, right? So in Texas, the heat actually, sometimes the heat will get so intense, they'll have eggs that won't hatch. They actually cook the eggs. They can have heat intensity can be a problem for broods. Again, they can't thermoregulate. So they can actually overheat in Texas, where we're having, you know, problems with exposure getting wet. Overwinter survival, the reason they kind of blink in and out, clear up into the Wisconsin area, is it's the winters are so tough. Not that brooding isn't tough too, but you know, they struggle with an overwintering population having anybody to breed the next spring. So really across the country, you see different, it depends on what region you're in as to really what their struggles are and what the lacking habitat characteristics are as well. Texas, they're struggling for rain usually. Drought is a limiting factor for quail habitat down there. Where I'm at, we get too much rain. The habitat, the grass gets too thick, the quail can't move around, so we need a higher disturbance rate to increase bare ground. Now I'm getting into the habitat management, but
That's okay.
Again, it's just this, it has such a wide range. There's just problems, different problems, similar. It's all structure related, but different causes across their range. But, you know, ice storms, we're kind of in the ice belt, so that can be catastrophic. Our winter, we don't get a lot of snow, but man, you get 6 days of ice. That's a problem. I mean, they can't get to seeds. They can't get to food. You know, anyway,
Let's talk a little bit about the whole survival. I don't want to say survival index, but the piece of this, you know, outside the weather, just food resources. And I think, you know, you mentioned, you know, I would assume grasshoppers, beetles, as they start to develop. But at that young stage of life, you know, what are they eating and consuming? What is that transition to? I'm assuming they want high protein calcium diets, right? Just for growth and potential. So what does that look like? What are they generally eating, and how does that evolve?
They're starting out again as youngsters. It's exclusively invertebrates, but it's a huge list. So yeah, grasshoppers are probably the most prominent in their diet as chicks up to, you know, 60 days old. But I mean, spider, you name it, spiders. Sure. Just any kind of invertebrates, they're picking on them, beetles, all kinds of stuff. They'll, as the fall comes along, they'll advance, they'll start shifting to seeds, but they'll keep eating bugs until those inverts, until, you know, freeze kills them off. Then they're going to shift to seeds. So again, diversity is important. So, you know, we don't always feel like McDonald's every day after day after day, and that wouldn't be healthy. It's probably not healthy any day, but so we need this diversity, right? They need some seeds that are higher in lipid content. They need some seeds that are higher in protein. All right. So if we can have, opportunities, fields that have 50 species of weeds instead of 5 species of weeds, you have a lot more seeds that are dropping on the ground. Ragweed, again, an example, attracts bugs. It's great in the summer, but it also has a highly nutritious seed. So it's wonderful. And we kill a lot of quail, Frank and I do, that have ragweed seeds in them. But they are not immune to using human created opportunities. So they will gravitate towards waste grains, the edges of crop fields. It, some cases, is not as healthy. For example, eating a kernel of corn or milo is not as healthy as ragweed seed, but they're a lot bigger. So you can fill your crop really quick with a bigger seed and go back to your plum thicket and not have to worry about getting killed by a hawk. If you're eating ragweed seeds, you got to bend over and pick up hundreds of those. And every time a quail bends down, is waiting to get killed by a hawk or coyote or anything else. So almost exclusively a seed diet all summer. There will be the, or all winter, I mean, they will pick some greens off and on throughout the year, especially in the springtime when they're getting ready to lay eggs. You know, they're going to switch over, and they're still, seeds are tough to find this time of year. They're going to start the newest shoots of green stuff. They'll start picking some of that, and that'll help for egg development and different things.
Now, just looking at, you know, this is, again, lack of experience, but looking at the specific bird, just looking at its physical status, right? It seems to, you know, not like a turkey. It's not going to be good at, you know, moving through leaf litter, et cetera. Like, so that becomes problematic. So I think earlier you brought the topic of bare ground, or, you know, basically not a lot of obstructions on the landscape for them. How critical is that throughout the life cycle and sequence in that, you know, 1 year time period, is, you know, having mass amounts of leaf litter, meaning, you know, you have some of these older forests, et cetera, and their utilization in those areas probably should be ideally lower, because again, it's hard to forage in those particular areas. So there's that foraging characteristic that I would think would be critical. Again, my lack of familiarity with the animal.
Yeah, super critical. The bare ground deal is probably one of their most limiting factors. Diversity of plant type with that bare ground, the right plant, so there's space between. That's probably range-wide their most critical habitat and the most limiting. When you start talking specifically about timbered landscapes and quail occupying those, there's a ton of research out of Oklahoma and the cross timber areas of Oklahoma. And you got to get down into a basal area of about 60 to get quail occupants, for quail to even set foot in there. So we're already talking an open woodland situation, because any more heavier basal area than that, it's just not going to have the herbaceous diversity they need. But you got to drop down into a basal area of 40 or below to get reproduction and full commitment, you know, year-round occupancy. So we're talking really open woodlands, and, oh, by the way, highly disturbed. In our big research project, we had over 1,500 radio-collared quail in Missouri, 500 nests we monitored over 5 years. A huge study. The number one indicator of where we would find a bird was time since disturbance. And if something hadn't been burned, grazed, strip disc, something, this is talking about open grasslands, right?
Sure, sure.
Diverse herbaceous fields, not even timbered areas. Open areas, if it hadn't been disturbed in the last 12 months, we had less than 5% use. It's almost wasted space. So that bare ground component is huge.
Okay.
They're called the firebird. Their nickname's a firebird, and there's a reason for that. They need that disturbance.
So I'm just picturing this, again, lack of experience, but pine savanna, oak savanna, those environments with massive amount disturbance, variation of grass and shrubs integrated within that kind of community. It seems like, assuming it has diversity, it seems like that could be an ideal scenario or opportunity for them. Again, right species composition sounds like it's very critical in this equation. That's just me talking without knowing anything about designing or layout. Would that be kind of like a generalist kind of, you know, idea?
100%.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. Some of the greatest quail populations that exist, now these are because it's super intense management, but are in South Georgia and North Florida. Pine plantations, not for pine lumber production. Mm-hmm. This is pine, open pine savannas that are managed, I mean, all in for quail, like hundreds of thousands of dollars dedicated to quail, because these plantations survive off of quail hunting and quail management.
All right. Well, you know, what if somebody's struggling, and I want to get into the habitat now here for the next 10 minutes. What if somebody's struggling to create these different diverse plant communities, and let's say they don't have the opportunity to use fire for whatever reason. We said earlier they're the firebird. What would you recommend? Let's scope this. Let's say historically the land uses was grassland, and it's been, you know, converted to a fescue pasture, and it's been grazed, so it's completely degraded. You know, mismanagement, overpopulation of deer, all the wrong stuff, right? And say, okay, we're going to minimize the deer herd, right? We're going to reduce cattle on the landscape, and maybe cattle is a good or bad thing in some capacity. How do we manage, you know, that scale, and what do we need to do? And let's take fire out of the equation. Let's just talk about managing a grassland area with herbicide, or just maybe it's a throw and grow. And, you know, what are you trying to do in those landscape? What technique do you employ, and how do you create this ideal community of plants?
Well, honestly, that's one of the easiest things that we can prescribe. Typically we run into this a lot, and it's that non-native cool season grasses. And yeah, taking fire away pains me. That doesn't help my cause, but it's doable. So as long as the site can be prepped, whether it, you know, is grazed down short or hayed or whatever, so we can get good contact, just a simple glyphosate application. And in most cases, it'll be super weedy. It may be mostly annuals, but what we typically find out 90%+ of the time is there's still enough native seeds in the seed bank to get a response. Yeah, it's not going to look like a native prairie that was there 300 years ago, but we can get a nice response, herbaceous response, some bunch grasses, some, you know, warm season bunch grasses, but then lots of weeds. And that was coined years ago. A researcher called it the new ground effect. So whether you're taking the crop field out of production, just let it grow up to weeds, or you kill out non-native cool season grasses, let it grow up to weeds, quail will actually explode in those situations, because it's nothing but habitat. It's, you know, 100% usable. As long as we have some woody escape cover associated, boom, we have instant habitat. We went from nothing to instant habitat, and the predators, the snakes and that eat the eggs, some of those don't have time to catch up, right? The first couple of years, it takes a while. So if you did that, say, on a 300-acre field, it's going to take a while for those predators to occupy that, but the quail can instantly use that.
Yeah, this is interesting, because I worked on a project here not too far from my particular area. We're dealing with eastern meadowlark. I don't know if you're familiar with that bird species, but these same practices that I think you may employ to establish that particular bird across the landscape. The other thing I was just thinking about was, if you're doing layout, like, I just think a lot of these people have these deer hunting properties, and this is something that I strictly try to get away from, especially if we want broad areas. I'm thinking turkeys, for example. We want this kind of large scale open areas, so, you know, turkeys can obviously convey their interests to other turkeys and strut, et cetera. And one of the things we try to do is remove perch trees in those particular areas. So we'll scale around those areas, a lot of shrubland, and then you'll have your food plot. And I see, and I'm just thinking about this, because predation, I'm assuming there's a lot, I'm assuming there's bird predation in this particular scenario. Birds probably just hammer these. I mean, what an easy meal. So having like trees within your food plots, probably not the best idea, at least from a perch standpoint. And I'm thinking out loud, but I'm just saying, when I'm designing like kind of the layout for turkeys, I'm removing perch trees, you know, where a hawk could sit and just take out everything. And I'm thinking this application, maybe there's a similar circumstance. And then I want to get into the species we're trying to promote. So it was just a thought in my mind. I'm just, you know, just,
well, yeah, no, you're 100% on target. There's actually no, to be honest, again, we have way more trees than we had historically in my part of the world, and a lot of the United States, for that matter, until you maybe get on the extreme eastern side. There's zero purpose for a tree in a quail's life. So if I was managing 1,000%, now this doesn't mean trees and quail can't coexist. I just told you South Georgia, some of those savannas are unbelievable. But think of West Texas, you know, mesquite, just brush country. That's also where there can be some amazing quail populations when they get rain. So Trees, no. Trees are providing sometimes dens for coons and possums as well, but also perch trees. You are exactly right. So yeah. We advocate taking those out. We want shrubs. We want dogwoods. We want sumac. We want plum. We don't need trees for quail.
All right, so let's dig in. You just started down the topic where I wanted to end on. Let's talk about, all right, so if this is Kyle Hedges' ideal, you know, design. Let's talk about, and this could be your own personal property. Obviously, I've listened to you quite a bit. I know that you've worked very hard on your own property. What's an ideal design look like to you? And be as descriptive as you can. Focus on, you know, kind of the vegetation scenario and how you manage that. And what does it look like and feel like? Just be as descriptive as you can.
Well, let me start with a... I guess kind of a exception here, maybe a comment. Are we talking quail and everything else be danged?
Yes, everything else. I want to just talk
more all inclusive.
No, okay. I don't want to be inclusive to any other animal. I want to focus on quail specifically because I want people to drive more interest in this particular species because I think we're focused on many other things. And obviously, we can talk about overlaps at the end if there are some overlaps with other species.
Well, then, yeah, I'm thinking of that Oklahoma, Texas, the old prairie landscape, grassland landscape. Literally, you know, there's a brushy clump every, Dr. Dale Rollins talks about you can throw a softball from clump to clump. So think about, you know, every 50, 75 yards, you've got a clump of brush, and I'm talking, in a perfect world, hundreds of acres of this, a diversity of plants. So we've got little blue stem side oats, some big blue stem, you know, these warm season grasses, but they're not dominating the landscape. We also have 100, 200 species of weeds, forbs, wildflowers, whatever you want to call them, ubiquitous across the landscape. So literally every inch of this provides nesting cover, but also brooding. They literally step out of the nest bowl. You know, they don't stay in the nest and they're not fed by the parents. They step out and they start picking bugs immediately. So I would have something like that. Say if I had a 300 acre farm, every inch of it would have those plant types, and I would checkerboard the heck out of it and disturb it. You know, the management part would then be disturbance with fire.
Okay, let's talk about some of the ideal species. You mentioned them earlier, dogwood, for example. What are some of those annual or perennial weeds that we want to have in these kind of communities? Some are fire responsive, some are not. So maybe talk a little bit about that quickly.
Yeah, the annual weeds, ragweed pops to mind. It's easy. It's disturbance, jumps right in there. Anything that has that umbrella shape to it, so leafy on top. But a bunch of perennials as well. They're super important. So think of coneflowers. Milkweeds attract a ton of bugs. They're deer resistant. Deer don't really like to eat them, but the bugs are there. So there's lots of things that the quail can pick bugs off of. Milkweed plants. There's a laundry list of some of them are pretty, some of them aren't. Doesn't matter. There's hundreds, and then the seeds as well. There's literally the quail eat hundreds of seeds of hundreds of species of plants. So the list is almost endless of what they can consume.
Yeah. And I'm just thinking offline, maybe, you know, some of the options like blackberry would be a good example. Some of the rubus species, I think those would be, you know, probably a good option.
Desmodium, so stick tights, not that we love them on our pants, but stick tights are a huge diet food. Partridge pea, so legumes, these are legumes, right? So they're super highly nutritious. Partridge pea is wonderful. They actually plant partridge pea food plots in the southeast just for quail. So again, tracks bugs all summer, but then has a nutritious seed in the wintertime.
And I'm thinking, you know, there isn't really probably a food plot scenario. Maybe you would want a standing grass, like you mentioned sorghum earlier, you know, that could be a, you know, plant accompanied and then you let it naturalize or whatever's around it naturalize and it becomes this housing kind of environment for them to kind of brood through, et cetera.
If I was, you know, quail existed long before we ever had commercial grains and food plots. But if I was, you know, in the South, Again, I want that maximized usable space. So that description I gave was just this solid landscape of that herbaceous cover. But if you push a little further north, over winter survival gets more critical. So again, it kind of depends on where we're at. And yes, some of the ideal food plots for quail, they love to consume Milo. I would have a rotation, so I would have food plots scattered around, but I would idle them. I would every other year, so only half my food plots would be getting planted. So every other year, each, you know, half of my food plots are just weedy, foxtail-y, leftover Milo, and ragweed and whatever wants to come in there. So you get the great combination that way, kind of more diversity.
And two other topics I want to just kind of hit on really quick. So the fire interval, and you mentioned that earlier, being a firebird. Can you just talk a little bit about the intervals of fire in a particular prescribed area and how you kind of manage it? Do you do fire annually in a particular area? Do you let it, you know, senesce for a year or two and then go back and you have an adjacent checkerboard area? How do you kind of lay that out typically with a prescription?
So again, depends on what part of the country we're working in and the rainfall amount, that climate. Around here, like I said, that 12 months since disturbance, anything beyond that, we got very little use. So we would prefer, if we're doing everything for quail, to be on a 50%. So 2-year burn rotation. We don't want to burn at all, right? We need somewhere to nest. We need some nesting cover early in the season because things wouldn't be growing back. This is warm season plants, right? They wouldn't be growing back for quail to be nesting in May. So 50% burn rotation or 2-year, whatever you want to call it, checkerboarded. Small units is ideal. Sometimes, unfortunately, in the interest of time and the amount of burn days, we have to burn 100-acre units. But if you could burn 25-acre units, that would be better, checkerboarded. As you move south, you get into Texas, you know, you're not burning 50%. They're drought. You might burn once every 5 years. So 5-year return interval or 6 years. But yeah, southeast, where quail really thrive, they're typically on that 2-year interval. Lots of times, just because of the way it is, the amount of burn days and the amount of acres that we have to try to cover on public land, around here in Missouri, we're on a 3-year return interval. So burn about a third of our open acres a year. That's what we try to do.
Okay. And I don't know if everyone knows where you're from. Where are you from specifically?
Southwest Missouri is where I work for the state and also consult across the country.
Right. You consult all over the place and obviously just not for quail or turkeys, deer as well. All right. So yes. I think those are my primary questions. And I just want to, you know, we're getting towards the end of this, any other topics that you think that, you know, people should absolutely consider? I know this is like a quick kind of punching round, but any other topics that you think are relevant that folks should think about this time of year, you know, in preparation, right? We're going into that breakup season, so to speak. So what are things they can do now or any other topic that you relay on the guests here?
I'm going to go down the road that everybody's fighting over right now in the turkey world, and it's habitat versus predator management.
Okay.
And quail are no different. There's umpteen studies out there that show if you don't have the habitat, killing all these predators or going into nesting season seems to make sense. We know we have record coon populations right now, record possum populations. I get it. I'm a trapper. But if the habitat is garbage or doesn't exist, killing all those predators doesn't do us any good. The habitat has to be in place first. It's frustrating, I guess, knowing people are spending hundreds of hours trapping. And again, I'm a trapper. In the name of supporting whatever species they're after, but they're not picking up a chainsaw. They're not doing any habitat work. Those hundreds of hours that you just spent running a chainsaw are more valuable on the front end. That has to happen first. So it's just priorities, whatever it is, whether it's burning, whether it's killing non-native grasses, thinning that timber down to a basal area that's appropriate for quail. All of those things are more important if you don't have tricked out habitat in the first place.
All right. I like the tricked out habitat focus. And that's kind of where we both are at. All right, Kyle, appreciate the time tonight, taking time out of your schedule. Love this information. If people want to get a hold of you, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Yeah, you can reach out to us, Land and Legacy. just search Land and Legacy. It'll pop up. You can call me direct. You can look up my, you can call me, text me, 417-399-2137. Anytime. Be glad to talk to people. Text me, call me, whatever. But reach out to Land and Legacy if you want more information, or you can talk to any of the guys that way as well.
Awesome. Yeah, I appreciate the time tonight. Thank you for all the information, and hope to talk to you again soon.
I appreciate it. I enjoyed it.
All right. Thanks, Cal. See ya.
See ya.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.